Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to the Hindu Studies channel of the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. I'm at rajbalkaran.com/academia. More importantly, today I get to speak with Dr. Itamar Theodore of Zifat Academic College in Israel on a very interesting publication, his Exploring the Bhagavad Gita, Philosophy, Structure, and Meaning. Hello, Itamar, how are you?
Hello, everything's fine. Good to hear you.
Yes, good to hear you. You know, we have done a little work together. I believe you published a paper from Bangkok's World Sanskrit Conference in 2015 on personhood.
Yes, indeed. I've been there and I published on personhood. I have much interest in personhood, personalism. And in fact, I'm going to be presenting next week a paper in an international conference on personalism, which this year will take place in Israel, surprisingly enough, yeah.
Oh, how convenient. So we've worked together remotely. I haven't had the pleasure of looking at this publication until preparing for this interview. One of the perks of doing this work really is having exposure to interesting works such as this one. I'm sure there are many people in our audience who are very familiar with the Bhagavad Gita, either from the perspective of scholarship. There probably are a number of listeners who may even use it in their personal life. And one thing I will say is, among the books we review here, this one has a great deal of application for those who are looking to interpret, perhaps even apply the principles of the Bhagavad Gita. Would you agree?
Yes, I fully agree with that, and that was the purpose of my interpretation. I realized that the Gita is very rich and is very flexible and open for various kinds of interpretations. I realized that. And my own interpretation is an attempt to present the Bhagavad Gita as having a unified structure and potentially making that into a philosophy, applied philosophy, if you like.
Yes, definitely. Now, one of the things, I mean, there are a number of things that are, the work that I do is very different, but there are a number of parallels in that I also look at text, and this idea that we can take our cues from the text itself. The text will tell us by its content and by its structure. I really do feel Sanskrit texts are structured so as to influence interpretation in some way. And it seems that you would agree with that idea.
Yeah, of course. I see the text as structured, and I'm trying to reveal the structure as I understand that, of course. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the structure that you perceive, and you know, you can feel free to talk about whatever you wish regarding the book or your work, but tell our audience about the structure that you talk about in your book.
Well, the structure, I call it the three-story house structure, and it's based upon a traditional view. Considering the Bhagavad Gita to be ladder-like. Actually, this is one of the ways to consider the Bhagavad Gita as having a ladder structure. Arvind Sharma writes about this in other places. So I did not invent that idea. And this idea, I think the roots are to be found with Vishwanath Chakravarti. That's the oldest source I found with this latter idea. He was a 17th, 18th century Bengali writer. And according to this idea, the Bhagavad Gita has a ladder, which is a karma yoga ladder. One follows one's dharmic duty and ascends the ladder through various stages of internal purification, sublimation. One can follow one's dharma with a utilitarian approach. One can go higher and try to do it through what I call dharmic utilitarianism. And then one can go higher and perform one's duty without regard to the fruits. That's a very famous, these very famous verses like 247, Karmani Eva Dikaraste, etc. You can perform your duty without regard to the fruits. This very famous, central, famous idea of the Gita. Then one can go higher and perform one's dharmic duty as a type of yoga, which is a very interesting idea. Being a yogi, a karma yogi, and performing one's dharmic duty, but with an internal state of being a yogi, controlling one's mind, training one's mind and senses, developing inner meditation. And ultimately, one can perform one's dharmic duty as bhakti, out of devotion, or alternatively, in a position close to that of Shankara's Advaita Vedanta, of kind of a monistic idea of merging with Brahma. That's also possible, and Shankara did comment upon the Bhagavad Gita. So that's the ladder. And the three stories, that's kind of my own innovation, I would say, and that is dividing the text into three layers of stories, which each has its own unique language and categories. I call the first floor the humanistic form, a floor of a dharma, the second one the second floor of yoga, and the third one the spiritual form. And we can see that in each floor there is a distinct set of ontology and ethics. For example, in the first floor you'll get the human being, that's ontology, but in the second floor you'll get something else, that will be the spirit soul, the eternal Atman, the self, which is different. Or the ethics of the first floor would be to prosper in this world, whereas the ethics of the second floor would be indifference, a yogic ethics of indifference towards samatva, towards success and failure. And the third floor will be the floor of bhakti, love of God. So that's basically the structure I see in the Gita. And accordingly, everyone, it's quite universal. Everyone can find a particular dharma, whether one is a professional dharma or a personal dharma, and start ascending the ladder while remaining socially responsible, not relinquishing, but relinquishing internally while the fruits of one's labor, but externally adhering to dharma, and in that sense remaining socially responsible in the family, in society. So that's basically the way I envision the Bhagavad Gita's structure.
The three-story house analogy is intriguing. The first thought that comes to mind is that it should be abundantly clear to anybody who engages the Gita, whether by verse or chapter, or someone who engages to read the whole thing in one sitting, it should be abundantly clear that there are contradictions left, right, and center. But also that these contradictions seem to me to apply to different degrees of resolution, different orders of resolution, even different orders of reality. So if you have an issue with your health, you know, a medical issue, that's the issue is occurring at the order of biochemistry. You won't seek out a physicist to address the atoms in your tumor, say. It seems to me that the Gita is operating on different orders of reality and levels of human experience. And so I really resonate with having three stories with respect to, well, which order of reality are we addressing now to navigate life? The first two strike me very much as, see what I've done is I've looked at various myths, the goddess mythologies of the Devi Mahatmya or even the epics, through the lens of this binary of pravriti and nivriti, world affirmation, world denial, royal ideology versus ascetic ideology. And it seems to me the first two stories of the house relate to what I call this double helix. The first story of the house relates to pravriti dharma, how to prosper in the world in a dharmic way. And the second story, if I'm not mistaken, of the house relates to the existential concerns or the impulse of contemplation or striving for some sort of spiritual goal. Am I mischaracterizing these first two stories, or is this the same?
No, I think you're right. I think the first one will be pravriti, and the second one will be nivriti. Represent the struggle, the endeavor to go there. The second story is characterized by a struggle. One struggles with one mind and senses. All these verses, like the second chapter about a turtle withdrawing its limbs within the shell, these verses which Gandhi loved. These are second story verses where one tries to detach oneself from sense objects and build up an internal meditation, so to speak. So that would be a nivritti, that struggle. And then the third story would be beyond struggling, when one has a conquered, if you like, and ceased struggling and is actually absorbed in that level of either moksha or bhakti, love of God, or a realization of oneness within that spiritual state.
So the third level is the level of the awakened soul, how one walks the world when one is awakened, presumably how Krishna functions, or presumably how the enlightened masters of India function, type thing.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is fascinating, because so when I see the text, I see these two orders of reality, pravriti and nivriti, and I see that there's a clever interplay of what the problem is. The text starts off with a pravriti problem, like a warrior needs to fight. This is a time of war. We need to protect the kingdom. And then the deeper problem is that he's suffering, he's lamenting, he's upset. And this is what launches Krishna's discourse of, you know, the wise do not grieve over the living or the dead. You know, like, what are you upset about? It's just really, really fascinating. I almost want to say it's a sleight of hand, but it's not. It's very conscious, but it's very subtle. This intermingling between, is the issue to get him to stand up physically and fight, or is the issue to get him to stand up spiritually?
I think you're really, really pointed at a very important juncture in the Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna, throughout the first chapter, speaks about, I don't want to kill my teacher, I don't want to die, I don't want them to die, this. And then Krishna says, Krishna changes the discussion's point of view. I call it the Copernican Revolution. He doesn't answer him directly, but he approaches the question from a higher level. He says, death? I don't see any death. The soul is eternal. The self is eternal. Which death do you see? I always existed, all these kings, you, I, all these, you know, Natvevaham, Jatuna, some of these verses. The soul is eternal. The Hinus Minata, he approaches the problem from a different point of view altogether, with a vision of eternity. So that's actually a very, I think, dramatic point in the Bhagavad Gita, the second chapter, where Krishna changes the level of discussion and speaks to Arjuna from a different point of view. Later, he returns back to that pravriti point of view in these verses about happy are the kshatriyas who can approach heaven through dharmic war and so forth. But in these verses about the self, the soul, these represent a different point of view where Krishna climbs or goes up, ascends to a higher story and speaks from a higher point of view.
So if you enjoy imagery, and clearly you do because of your three-story house analogy, you know, when I think about what we call Hinduism, or certainly when I teach it, I think of the image of a double helix. And so I think of it as the dharmic double helix. There's a pravritti strand and a nivritti strand. And both have to, they'll never touch. Neither strand of the double helix will ever touch. They're contradictory, they're structural opposites. But together they're woven. It appears to be one image. And you have to somehow see the pravritti side and the nivritti side in that. The problem isn't what Arjuna has to do. I mean, that is up to question. What your right action is up to question, whether right action is being a butcher or not being a butcher for your dharma, or being a warrior or not being a warrior. But the problem becomes how he feels about it, what he thinks about it, how he views it. It becomes the problem of suffering and right seeing. And so it seems to me that Krishna's ability to reframe the problem from the perspective of your read, I would say that's because he is in the third state. He is in the third level of the house.
Yeah.
Only because he's in the third level of the house could he begin to see the first two so clearly and be able to shift between one and the other effortlessly. Whereas for us, we may be baffled to shift from both of these orders of reality, but he can presumably do that because he's at the third level of the house, which is really just the apex of right seeing, you know, it seems to me.
I think this is a wonderful articulation of the Gita. I support, of course, and I think you're stating it wonderfully.
What? There's so much to say, and part of why this is a rich conversation is because it's about an extraordinarily rich text, like the Bhagavad Gita. You know, we have to keep in mind whether we're here to talk about the Bhagavad Gita or to talk about your book on the Bhagavad Gita. Let's limit it to the first, and then we can expand into the second if time permits. You know, those among our audience are probably not going to be used to so accessible a book. This is a book wherein the Gita is translated and commented upon. Yes. Now, from the perspective of scholarship, comment on the fact that this is a very atypical kind of enterprise.
I realize that. I've seen many Gita editions, and most offer an introduction. And once they done with the introduction, they offer the full text. There are some exceptions. One famous exception is Zener's, R.C. Zener's a Bhagavad Gita edition published by Oxford University Press in the 1960s, I believe. And he does two things, which I follow. One, he divides the text into sections, which I've also done. I don't offer a full chapter, but I divide a chapter into sections of about 10 verses each. I group them together. I also name them, which is kind of an editorial intervention, if you like. And then I offer a commentary trying to explain what's happening in this section. What is the text about? What is it saying? What is the significance? So I do that. And as I mentioned, I follow Zener. I see myself in some ways as continuing his work, hopefully, in some ways. So yeah, I am doing that. I am dividing the text into sections. And I'm offering a commentary following each section, a short commentary, which will help to read the whole Gita from beginning to end. That are about 70 sections throughout the whole entire book. And each section is followed by a half a page, one page commentary. Something like that.
Is the commentary geared towards academics, scholars of the Gita, or is it geared towards aspirants, or both?
I mean, in one of my reviewers, Hamza Stanton in Philosophy East and West, has written that I actually offer two books in one. And I agree with that. That for the scholars, I would say that my main argument is the structure. That would be more interesting for scholars. And the commentary would be more interesting, I think, for readers, either academic readers, students, and also general readership. But perhaps also for academics. I'm not sure exactly about the borders. But I am aware of that division between a logical, a theoretical argument, which will be the structure argument, and the commentary, which will be for accessibility, for explaining, for maybe touching the spirituality of the text. Yes, so I do agree with that distinction.
Well, it was more of a question in terms of the intended audience, because for me personally, because of my background and my perspective on life, an academic book need not preclude a book that is useful for those trying to understand the text in their own lives. I mean, it's difficult to do them both well. But for me, the richness of the Gita is not just as a repository of the history of ideas. The richness of the Gita is as a guide map to lived human experience. I mean, the whole bloody point of it is, how do you live your life? And so while that may not be or fall squarely within the responsibility of an academic, certainly not of a historian of religion, maybe not even someone stringently doing philosophy or ethics, or even narrative theory, nevertheless, the huge pink elephant in the room of anybody writing on these texts is that the text is meant to be embodied and lived. And we academics, we scholars, we, as in the times in which we are functioning as scholars, obviously need not, ought not, should not write from that perspective. But the power is acknowledging that perspective. We must know that that perspective exists, and that is the point of the text. I may be biased, but my sense is that it's necessary to acknowledge the life of the text. Do you, how did this project come about? Did you have a history with the Gita? Was this part of your studies? Did you have, you know, tell us about your interest in the text and how this book arose.
Well, I began my engagement with Indian spirituality on a personal level. I have to admit that I was around the age of 20, and I started practicing yoga and various forms of bhakti.
So when you say you're around the age of 20, the listeners may not know that was 5-10 years ago, correct?
I'm now 59 and a half.
They don't need to know your age, but to give them a sense of the epoch. This is a couple of decades ago.
So that's how I began my engagement, personal journey, if you like, into Indian spirituality. And it was fascinating. And then I decided to become an academic of that field. And I went to school and studied. That's basically my story. So I did have, and I still have some experience of Indian spirituality, although I don't think it's so strong as it was when I was young. But I'm definitely fascinated, and I became a scholar of that this tradition. Yeah.
So in terms of the structure of the book, have you come across any work on ring composition? Is this familiar to you?
Not really.
No, it's not hugely popular, but maybe I'll send you a link after this conversation. The reason I ask is because I noticed that many Sanskrit compositions are composed as narrative rings, where the structure of it is circular, and there's a midpoint in the text from which you can interpret the rest of the text. It's an idea I played with while looking at the goddess myths, and now I see ring composition everywhere. So I'll send it to you. But where did you get the inspiration of looking at the structure? Like, how did that come up for you? Was it a thinker? Did it just strike you naturally? Or where did that come from?
Naturally, it wasn't a particular thinker. I just looked at the Gita and said, wow, there must be an... I remember even the moment it came, I was studying in my MA, and it came to me. We were studying a philosophy of religion in one of these courses, and I said, wow, I have to figure out the structure of the Gita. It was something that I would say kind of internal. I did learn in a traditional seminar in India before going to school, and I was exposed to this idea of the ladder. I gave credit in my book to that school, and later I found out that the roots go to that thinking, which I mentioned, Vishwanath Chakravarti. So as far as the ladder, that was a traditional idea, which I joined that with three stories and made it in those three stories house. So the idea of the ladder is something I was exposed before. I did divide the text kind of myself into these three layers and brought it together into this three-story house. So I did apply some traditional idea, but that passion for structuring the Gita, for highlighting its structure, for trying to show it as a unified text, I guess I had it. It struck me as something which one has to do, I don't know.
And it seemed also obvious to me that the texts were structured in a very, very conscious way. Even when they were ironically, the more redacted they are, the more quote unquote interpolations there are, the richer that history, to me, the more consciously the final product was structured. And so there was a great deal of effort put into what goes where, what order the chapters occur in, which part of the Gita occurs in, the Devi Mahatmya, why is it the Markani Purana? They could have put it anywhere. They could have put it anywhere. Why? There has to be a reason. This isn't a careless, haphazard, let's just stick it there because this happens to be the pile of manuscripts we're copying over today. And so so it's abundantly clear. There's to me anyhow, I agree with that insight that there's a very conscious crafting of how the chapters are structured. And I don't think it's blatantly obvious because I think there are a number of things happening at the same time, right? Like there is method to the madness. So maybe...
That's nice. Yeah, method to the madness.
Yeah, maybe you should say a little bit about specifically how you see the work structured with respect to these three stories.
Well, the first level, that of Dharma, has a lot to say about it. In general, it speaks about Varna Ashrama Dharma. That's quite universal. It aspires to encompass human society. It actually connects to or potentially connects to each and every human being. Everyone is doing some work, some kind of activity, and this can be sublimated, whether it's personal, like being a father, a mother, or a son, or a husband, wife, and so forth, whether being professional means Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, that actually encompasses the whole of human society. So it's very wide and universal, and it's also a world-affirming. It's encouraging prosperity. It actually wants to see the world as a healthy, happy, peaceful, prosperous place. So that is the first story. Then the second story is more existential. As you mentioned before, it's more existential. It looks upon one's existential state in life. What am I doing here? Who am I? What is the goal of life? How can I overcome this problem of birth and death? And while being in one's dharma, that's maybe the very interesting point of the Gita. While being in one's dharma, one can uplift oneself and see things from a higher perspective, more spiritual, and in the same time, restrain oneself, become a more self-controlled, more of a yogi, more spiritual, and be a better person in society, not go to the forest, but work one's life, be in one's family, and be a karma yogi. So that's a higher level. Then, of course, if you go to the third level, that's there one can go into spiritual realizations. One can have spiritual visions. That will be mystical visions, if you like. A love of God, seeing all creatures, seeing the oneness of all beings. That's completely mystical state. And one can do that while being in the world, while being dharmic. One can be a mystic in one's work. So I think it's fascinating, and it's all-encompassing, and it, it, it touches all spheres of life. One can find oneself in the Gita wherever one is. Where, and now that's before even touching the three gunas, that the Sankhya idea of the three gunas. How can one look at oneself from the point of view of the gunas? I'm now in sattva, but perhaps now I'm in rajas. I'm in passion. But from that passion, I can be elevated. I can also engage my passions in a yogic way. Even my tamas, my darkness, my ignorance, even that has a place in my existence. For example, I sleep. Sleeping is a tamas. And that is a very holistic way of life. I've done some work, comparative work, on the Bhagavad Gita and Chinese philosophy, and actually published a co-edited book called Brahman and Tao, and I have a chapter on the Gita and Chinese philosophy. And that brings from the Gita what I call the naturalistic aspects, things which don't come so in the Gita's meeting with the Western thought. It brings the yin and yang aspects, and I think the Gita actually has these naturalistic aspects, which are very interesting, and they see reality in a different way, in a non-rational way, in a more of a particular a world through the gunas, which is a whole other view, which is there in the Gita. So I think the Gita is fascinating from each and every point of view you look at it.
So do you see, for the benefit of our audience, are certain chapters dedicated to certain stories of the house?
Well, in general, yes. I would say first chapter is first story. Then second chapter, you have the whole ladder all the way from the lower, all the way up. Then third chapter, Karma Yoga, would basically be a first story. And then a fourth chapter, various things. Fifth chapter, very similar to the third chapter, also a first story, Dharma. And then sixth chapter is definitely a yogic, a very distinctly a second story. And then seventh chapter is, that's where the text enters the third story from the beginning, very clearly. Even Zener points out that there's a change of values there at the beginning of the seventh chapter. It goes into theology, visions of divinity, of Godhead, about how God can be seen in the world. Ninth chapter is also similar. Eighth chapter goes a little down to the second story. And now I'm 10th chapter will again be divinity. And 11th, divinity, 12th, also. And then 13 goes down to the yogic plane of the second chapter. 14th, 15th. 15th is another story because it shows the whole ladder. But 16th is the lower one, the demons. And then 17th and the first half of 18th will be, again, the gunas. The humanistic platform of various levels of action, according to the three gunas, and then at the end, from verse 45, before the summary of the Bhagavad Gita. So yes, you can actually show the stories, the levels through the text. When does it go higher? When does it go lower? Basically, the middle of the Gita, chapters 7 to 12 are the highest level, with the exception of chapter 8, which is slightly lower. I know traditional commentators like to divide the Gita into the first six, second six, and last six chapters. It works, but it doesn't work that well because the text is more complicated, more sophisticated. But you can, I certainly try to point at the levels through the commentary on which level the text is speaking.
So when you, for example, say that there's a different tone that occurs from chapter 7 onwards, the introduction of this mystical dimension, Is that retained throughout, or is that a theme that's concentrated in the middle of the Gita?
Well, the peaks are chapter 7, then chapter 9, and then chapter 10. That's where Krishna reveals his divinity, and Arjuna surrenders. He says, I accept your divinity, and then Krishna describes how he's to be seen in the world. So that will be, I think, the highest theological peaks. The 11th chapter is also, it's different, but it's also a revelation, theodicy, revelation. That these chapters will be the peak, the theological peak of the Gita. And then at the end of the Gita, the text returns to these peaks, almost word for word. I mean, the concluding verse of chapter 9 is there in 1865, more or less the same verse, maybe one word difference. Become a devotee and so forth.
One of the principles of ring composition is that the composition ends where it begins. It comes full circle, it's a ring. But at the middle, the midpoint or the middle is highlighted, it's featured, it's the most important, it's central, literally central, as well as thematically central.
I'm not sure it's the most important, but it's the highest. I think it's all important. I mean, just the second, the second part, I mean, the middle chapters in themselves would be sufficient. The whole thing together creates these dynamics. But yes, the middle part is in many ways the highest theological parts. That's where one goes beyond the struggle with the senses and the mind and actually attains visions, darshans. I think I mentioned it in the commentary that at this point, the conversation is not any more argumentative, but rather a visionary. Krishna tells Arjuna, open your eyes and see. I am the taste of water, the light of the sun and the moon, the ability or humanity in the human being and so forth. That's a vision. It's not an argument. It's not an imperative. It's a vision. Open your eyes and look around, see how the world is structured. Look around you, see divinity everywhere. I think these are beautiful, beautiful verses. And they are basically darshans, visions, mystical visions, if you like.
So it's from one perspective, it seems to make sense that they begin on the battlefield and ascend into this more spiritual, mystical space in the heart of the matter, and then return towards the battlefield at the end of the text. There seems to be an overarching up the mountain, down the mountain.
Yes,
feels.
Exactly. I think you that wonderfully. Going up the mountain and then down the mountain, but going through a whole journey, and then returning to the battlefield, but enlightened this time. Enlightened. Yeah.
Was there anything about this? This process of yours writing this book, was there anything that was particularly either challenging, or were you surprised in some ways? Is something that struck you? Could you comment about what you learned while writing this book, or were there any bumps in the road?
Well, it was a journey. I first wrote a Hebrew edition, and that was good. But then I went to study in Oxford. And that was where I wrote the mature book, the English version. I did the whole thing from the beginning again, did a new translation. I mean, the same translation, but I did from the beginning. I expanded the commentary, and I felt that actually I'm coming with something new. Actually, a friend of mine who's a philosopher, he said, "You actually your argument is that you have discovered." A philosophical book, that actually the Gita is not only a wonderful work of wisdom or spirituality, but it's actually a real unified philosophy. And that idea I very much felt in Oxford, that I felt that I was kind of one of the centers of world scholarship. And from that point of view, I said, wow, I have a new philosophy. Asian philosophy, Indian philosophy, Hindu philosophy, that's what I'm actually doing. And I did that at the theology faculty, the University of Oxford. And that place is actually traditional. Many great theologians actually work there. So I felt, yes, this is the place to work out a philosophy with the world ambitions. And I start talking about the Gita as a potential philosophy for the 21st century, something which can unite East and West, which has also theistic trends, which can correspond with Western spirituality, Christianity, Judaism, Islam. It also has Chinese elements, or elements which can correspond with Chinese philosophy, as I mentioned, Yin Yang, the Gunas, and other things, Tao, Brahman. And I actually start to see the Gita as a potentially 21st world philosophy, which to my mind is not in the East, but in the middle, in between East and West. East means China, West means the West, and the Gita geographically in between. So yes, I started to think in these terms while doing the work, while writing the book.
So could you maybe clarify for us, when you say you consider it now philosophy rather than just wisdom or lore or spiritual nourishment, you know, in what sense do you mean that? Do you mean, like, in what sense do you mean you've started considering it philosophy proper?
Well, I think that first of all, because of geopolitical changing circumstances, Asia is not anymore the Far East, as it used to say, but becomes much more central and much more dominant, also in terms of philosophy. So I think it's less esoteric and more applicable. Yeah, I actually think in these terms, I have various ideas how to apply the Gita in day-to-day life. I even think that some of the Western terms could correspond to the Varnas. For example, we have the business sector, which corresponds to the Vaishyas. We have the public circle, the government, army, administration, that corresponds to the Kshatriyas. We have the third sector, as they call it, of educators, that could correspond to the Brahmins. So I have some ideas how the Gita can actually be applicable, how it can actually be turned into a philosophy, which could unify East and West, be accepted by Western thinkers, Eastern thinkers. I mean, I actually have these ideas of the Gita as a potentially universal, doctrine, philosophy, which fits, which is suitable for post-modernity. I think that modernity has its underlying assumptions, which may be questionable. I mean, a human being as rational, rationality being the central quality of a human being, the idea of a choice, free choice. I'm not sure. I think the Gita is much more postmodern and much more fitting a postmodernity, in that one has different degrees of subjectivity according to one's position in the gunas. In these terms, I see the Gita as a postmodern, potentially a postmodern global philosophy.
In your perspective, do you see any potential intrigues or pitfalls to this universalizing of the Gita? Do you see any drawbacks? Or would you consider, I mean, it seems to me what you're saying is that the Gita is potentially an adequate universal philosophy to be applied to postmodern life. And so might there, in your perspective, be any pitfalls with that line of thinking?
Well, if it becomes too nationalistic, it can be a pitfall. I mean, it can easily lose its spirituality and become chauvinistic, nationalistic, violent. That would be a pitfall. It's difficult sometimes to keep the spirituality And it's easier to kind of accept the more external, I would say, aspects. So yeah, every philosophy has a pitfall. And the Gita can also be misused, no doubt. I don't think that everything said on the strength of the Gita is always absolute truth. But every philosophy can be misused, and also the Gita. So it has potential pitfalls. I'm sure it does. But by and large, I think it has potential to contribute in the present day and age, in 21st century. But of course, it can have pitfalls. Other philosophies can be also very worthwhile. I don't think that this is the only way. And you know, it has to be a balanced approach to every philosophy.
So you see it as one of several sources of philosophical, spiritual inspiration to practically change the postmodern world or way of life.
Yeah, I see that as a potential philosophy, not the only way, but I see it. And I also think that with the rise of Asia, both China and India, they very much want to have their voice also, not only financially and politically, but also philosophically. And it might happen gradually, maybe yes, maybe not, that there'll be some kind of unification between Indian, Chinese, and Western philosophy, and the Gita can potentially occupy a place, even a central place there. But let's see, I can't really foresee the future, but there is a potential there, which I do see. I was also working in Hong Kong. I was teaching there for a few years at Chinese University of Hong Kong. And I also saw the ongoing attempts to articulate contemporary Chinese philosophy. I see it in India. So it might happen, and the Gita may occupy a place there. Also, there's much, many attempts to articulate neo-Gandhian philosophy. Now it's 150 birth anniversary. And Gandhi, of course, also, his ideas were focused around the Gita in many ways.
So clearly from our conversation, you enjoy comparative work. So that you've looked at the Gita, and you've mentioned in passing some comparison to Chinese religious texts. Are you currently working on any comparison, or maybe comment on your favorite or most fruitful point of comparison?
Well, I did work, as I mentioned, on comparative Indo-Chinese ideas, published a book there. I published another co-edited book with Judith Greenberg, just 2018, last year, about comparative Hindu-Jewish studies, Hinduism and Judaism. And right now, I'm editing a book on the Gita to be published in India, an edited volume on the Gita. This one is not a comparative volume, but a book on the Gita, which hopefully will be in press in a year or whatever.
So tell us a little bit about the edited volume. Is there a specific theme or bent, or how many papers are in this volume, and is there, what unifies them? What is the purpose of this this collection?
Well, that edited volume, we have about 10 chapters, either 10 or 9, we'll see, with some famous writers such as Arvind Sharma. And we have a paper by the late Joseph O'Connell, the Canadian scholar, who passed away in 2012. And we have a chapter by Richard Davis, who have just published, a few years ago, his book, The Bhagavad Gita Biography. I would say that I'm the editor of that volume. I write the introduction. And then I write about the structure. That structure is, I would say, the unifying theme. I also quote Arvind Sharma's chapter, where he speaks about the idea of the ladder as a way to interpret the Bhagavad Gita. Not the only way, though, but it is a way. He mentioned the ladder. I very much quote Joseph O'Connell's chapter, who is looking at the very interesting conjuncture between bhakti, devotion, and dharma or karma. It's a question. And he mentions very particularly, he writes quite a bit about this thinker, which I mentioned, Bhishmana Chakravarti. And so this, from my point of view, is the unifying structure of that book too. See, I'm unifying structures. I always do that. We have a chapter by Carl Olson on Shankara's Gita's commentary. Then we have a chapter by Alexander Muskokov about the Bhagavad Gita and Sri Vaishnavism. I mean, we take a Ramanuja and then Shankara and then a Ramanuja. Richard Davis's chapter is about the Gita Mahatmyas. And then we have a chapter by Jim Ryan, who writes about the nationalistic thinkers, Gandhi, Sri Aurobindo, and Bal Gangadhar Tilak, their understanding of the Gita. And then we have a chapter by John Lulin, who is writing about the Gita of the Gurus. And he takes five gurus and writes how they interpreted the Gitas, their Gita commentaries. There may be another chapter, which I'm not sure yet. That chapter I wrote about the Gita as a potentially all-Indian book. And in that chapter, I show how the Gita can be compatible with nine religions in India. Of course, Hinduism, then Buddhism, quite easy. And then Jainism, of course. Then Sikh religion. Then Judaism, some Jews in India. Christianity, of course. Then Islam, I show how the Gita can be compatible with Islam, and then Baha'i and Zoroastrian religions. So we'll see if that chapter will be included, but that's basically the book with myself, then Arvind Sharma, Carl Olson, Alexander Uskakov, Joseph O'Connell's chapter, Richard Davis, Jim Ryan, and John Lulins.
Well, that certainly sounds like a fascinating collection of papers. We'll have to have you back on the program once that new book emerges. So for those of you listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Itamar Tiror at Zafat Academic College in Israel about a book that was actually originally published in 2010 with Ashgate and is just now this year, 2019, out with Routledge India. It is a book on a very famous Hindu text, the Bhagavad Gita. The title is Exploring the Bhagavad Gita, Philosophy, Structure, and Meaning. Thank you very much for this very fascinating chat.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful to be with you.
All right. Take care. For those of you listening, until next time, keep reading. Take care.